okay, what do you want? Do you want to be a service catalog and focus on the enterprise asset management element, or do you want to cater the developers? Those are two very, very different personas with very different needs.
This season, Andy and Mark are back with a fantastic group of guests.
I've been to depths that remain classified, and Mark keeps his head in the clouds. With our combined experience in the industry, we can go from the bare metal to the boardroom.
In DevOps Sauna Season 3, we'll explore platform engineering and the people and cultures that make it happen.
Enjoy your time in the DevOps Sauna.
Okay, we are back in the sauna. I have my usual cohort, Andy Allred.
Hello, happy to be here as always.
And I'm super excited to talk for the second time with Casper von Grunberg, founder and CEO of Humanitech. How are you today, Casper?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And we spent just a little bit of time together in Copenhagen last autumn, and you captured me with a lot of the thoughts on humanity and platform engineering, and I really wanted to get you on the podcast. I'm so glad you could come. So tell me, you know, what's on your mind today? What are you looking at?
I had a conversation earlier this week with a platform engineer, actually, and he quoted Alan Kay, a computer scientist who worked on Perl. And the quote said, "We should design platforms that make simple things simple and hard things possible." And that very much resonated with me because it's summarizing, I believe, the key thing in platform engineering. That is, how can you actually design paths and pathways that are respectful towards every single individual contributor and everybody who is actually working with these platforms. There are a lot of different users, but how can you accommodate their individual preference? And so that's really top of mind for me at the moment.
This idea of, can we actually please everybody? And we're talking about computer scientists.
Yeah.
I think it's a lovely idea, and it's something that, of course, we're trying to do in all of our work when we are doing platform engineering. How do you go about that? You know, there's so many different needs for so many different people and kinds of teams, and there's always that guy who argues about everything that's not exactly what he has, and he'll argue about that if there's nothing else.
Well, I think platform engineering shares a lot of the same principles with good management practice. If you are running an organization or you're managing a team, the team has different needs and there are individuals. Some people are very vocal, some people are reserved. Good management practice means you hear all voices, you take all the different factors into consideration, and then you make a decision and you explain to everybody why you're making that decision. People get the context. I think we're very social animals, if you want, and people are okay to take one for the group. But you need to explain that and you need to be transparent. And that's the same for platform engineering. You need to hear the different voices and then you need to prioritize and you need to explain why you're making decisions and then you'll be fine.
I like this. You know, something that we talk about a lot is, what does it mean to listen? And one of my favorite definitions of listening is, you know, trying to listen to understand, not listen to respond or listen to, you know, for other reasons, but listen to really understand where people are coming from.
Yeah, that is so vital. And not many people are doing it.
When you're talking about hearing all voices and then decide, it just reminds me back in my Navy days, before any mission, we always had the pre-mission brief and we talked through everything. And during this pre-brief, everybody's expected to speak up about anything. And it doesn't matter if you're the colonel or the corporal or anybody in between. If you have an opinion about something, you are required to bring it up. And it doesn't mean that whatever you say will influence the decision. Meaning, if I say we should do this way, it doesn't mean it's going to go that way. But everybody then left with the with the feeling and the comfort of knowing that their point of view has been taken into consideration. Maybe because of XYZ, doing something else was the better choice overall, but at least my point of view was considered and weighed against all the other options. And just knowing that makes so much difference.
So much difference. And so I'm a big believer, for instance, in written decision management. So if we make a really daunting decision, we write an like a working paper, a memo, or an operation, and we take a little too much time structuring our thoughts around this. And then we actually do the same thing. Like we gather everyone and say, okay, you now have a mandate to, you know, criticize this, tear this apart, try to find the loopholes. And as you say, then everybody's in the loop and you can say, maybe you say, I disagree, but then you say, I disagree and commit. And then we say, okay, for the next, whatever the execution period is, we'll not look left, we'll not look right, we'll not do things 80%, we'll do things 100% because we're all aligned on that goal. And that's exactly the challenge, the complexity with platform engineering. It has a lot of cultural elements to it.
Are there some examples of what type of things can be very difficult, especially at a cultural level, to make these kinds of decisions? Like one thing that I could kind of put out is I've seen companies that want to execute cultural change in an organization by doing a tool chain change.
Yeah.
Consciously.
Yeah, and that almost never works, right? So assuming you can bring in a tool, I mean, a lot of vendors will tell you that and will try to sell that, but you can't compensate a problem by just throwing another tool at it. That's impossible. My favorite example is one of the questions in platform engineering. Where do you cut, right? How do you abstract? Do you abstract at all? Abstraction is like in itself a dangerous world because it's implying you're taking away context. So how do you balance that thing? How do you make sure that you hear the Linux kernel hacker and you hear the junior front-end engineer and the product manager? And how do you make sure that management is not overshouting at all and say, that we should start with fancy dashboards? That's a very, very delicate thing. And so the easy answer is usually, that isn't necessarily the right one. And that's especially the case if you have like a multi-attribute problem, like platform engineering or complex tool chains. It's so absurd. People say, oh, there's so many tools. Well, if you look at every factory, right, that's building a car, think about how many tools there are in these factory halls. And of course, there are many tools. Like a car is a complex thing. Everybody knows a car because they can feel it. Not many people know distributed microservice architectures and how complex these things are if you run them at scale and how much pressure there is on these teams to get that right. And so we always think that, these digital assembly lines should be so simple, but they're not simple. It's a really, really complex thing.
You had me for a moment because you said the easy answer is, and I was waiting for the easy answer, but it's like almost never.
I was talking about this abstraction and how do you, where do you find the abstractions with a customer a couple weeks ago. And they were basically saying the platform engineering is going to be too complicated and is never going to work because these abstractions are never good. You can't have abstractions and do things properly. And I said, well, how do your developers decide how the electricity is made, which goes into the server? How do the developers influence the design of the silicon inside the chip? How many of your developers are committing to the kernel? So let's just accept that there are abstractions. And instead of saying no abstractions, let's make a conscious and informed decision at what level we think the abstractions is the right place to put for our environment in our way of working with our organization. But then it kind of shifts the thinking. And then we're talking about, okay, where do we bring value and where can we make changes that will help us instead of this just, well, abstractions are bad kind of discussion, which happens way too easily.
And what they're forgetting is that if you're not thinking about these things consciously, the abstractions build themselves. So if you have an incredibly nasty CI/CD setup that nobody really cares about, that is a huge abstraction, right? Because nobody gets it. And it's an abstraction that's, you know, you didn't willingly decide to build it that way, or you didn't consult anybody. It's just a horrible abstraction and you're left with having your people deal with these things, and nobody really wins. So it's assuming that if you're not taking action, things will be fine. That's just wrong.
Horrible and complicated CI/CD pipelines. I've never seen that except every company I ever worked with.
Exactly.
You connected so many dots for me, Cosper, just now, which is like, if you don't take head on the essential complexity, then it simply results in accidental complexity.
Yeah, that's really the problem. And so if people say, oh, I'm not sure we're building, we want to build an internal developer platform, I always respond with, hey, you know, you've built it already. The problem is you're not treating it right. And so it's really nasty. What is an internal developer platform? It's the sum of all of the tech and tools that you have, right? There is not this golden bullet out of the box thing. I mean, there is. It's called Heroku, right? And everybody who can use Heroku, I always say, like, please use Heroku if you can. Please use every single platform as a service product on the market before you actually do these things yourself. But if you have to do these things yourself, and that the uncomfortable truth is that's 90% of the market, especially with enterprises, well, then you either focus on building your platform the right way or it builds itself.
Cool. What are some trends that are going on right now in platform engineering?
Well, I think that everybody smells that there is something to do, especially in the last 12 months, you know, Gartner predictions, and people are, you know, using the usual buzzwords, golden path and IDP and portal and platform engineering. And part of the problem is that there's a lot of confusion. And frankly, there are a lot of people shouting stuff. And one of the biggest confusion is probably that you can get something out of the box and your life will be good. That's not going to happen because there is not that tool. It's localized to the situation your organization team is in. There are patterns, right? There are blueprints, but there is not the one. That's number one. I think the biggest fallacy that I'm seeing is that people believe that or that they confuse a portal or a service catalog with a platform. That I think is number one. Like everybody thinks, let's build a nice user interface where people can now actually, I am not even sure what they can do now in that portal. Like they can see stuff. And then they say, okay, by seeing stuff, by visualizing stuff, it will get better. And a friend of mine, Lee, wrote a great article saying, if you put a pane of glass on a pile of shit, you still see a pile of shit. It doesn't change, right? Like you can't build the front door first, but there is no house. You need to build the house and then you can build the front door. Putting like a UI on top of something makes sense in specific situations, but just to try to calm down your management because now they can see stuff, it doesn't really change the workflow. And I'm always feeling so sorry for these teams that pour so much, you know, heart and energy into building shiny green portals, and you know they look stunning, and then you look at the usage rates and developers, I mean, it's a break in their workflow, right? They stay in code. It's another interface that they're supposed to use. Reality is they don't use it. And then I saw this portal of a very, very large European e-commerce player the other day, and I looked at the users. We looked at the user stats, and so developers were using it twice a year. They logged in twice a year when they were building new services, but not actually to use the templating flow because they circumvented using GitHub templates because what the UI did is actually called the GitHub template API. No, they looked at this to actually use the search function to see whether there had been services built before that they can reuse, like the classical inner source case. And you can enable the inner source case with probably 5% of the investment that this team had done into that portal. So I think that's the biggest problem at the moment, that people are looking for easy fixes. They're avoiding, you know, building the fundamentals and getting the fundamentals right. And that leads to really nice looking portals that nobody's using.
We've had a lot of conversations with our EffiCode customers recently about Backstage, which is picking up a lot of steam in the industry and getting a lot of publicity and making a lot of noise. Just making sure for anybody listening, Backstage is a developer portal coming out of Spotify, and it's really interesting and keen, but it's only a portal. And we've been having customer discussions where they're like, okay, we need Backstage. Okay, that's fantastic. We can help you put in Backstage. it's a portal to help visualize these 57 other things that your developer platform needs. Who's taking care of these other things? I don't know, but we want Backstage. And it's like, as you said, companies too easily are focusing on what's the technical solution we come in, what's the one tool we put in that solves everything. It's sometimes really hard to get a discussion about what's the overall thing we're trying to solve. Then I've seen even some people who put in a conference talk with a title like DevOps is Dead just to generate conversation. So then it'll come up and like, okay, no, it's not dead. Okay, you're right. Now let's talk about it.
This pane of glass in front of the shit, you know, I'm not sure if I'd rather have that or a flaming bag of it on my doorstep, which also kind of came out of this conversation. But this minimum level of useful visibility kind of thing is, I think, a really interesting topic. Like what, because every big enterprise customer that I talk to, you know, the fragmentation is, you know, it's unbelievable that they can get anything done. You know, so then is there something to pull this together?
Well, don't get me wrong. We need to be very precise here. I'm not saying that an enterprise service catalog is a bad idea, but I'm actually advocating for, like, what do you actually need it for? Should you have an asset management for all your stuff? Yeah, you should. I mean, you know, no question. If you have a sufficient size, that's absolutely the case. I think that the problem is that we are conflating the needs of the product management and management layer, because they actually need asset management and like a surfacing what's going on, right? Very important. Like, where are we in the transformation? There are tools like Lean IX or like these large asset management systems. But I think what happened is that we tried to actually mix the asset management approach, which is geared towards informing product management functions, and we're trying to actually shove this down the developer's throat. And the developers are focused on one element, right? They don't have the pain point that somebody has who's overseeing 200 services. That's a very, very important differentiation. And now we're saying, like every developer is supposed to use this new UI because we're calling it a developer portal. And you can see that, like, all of these describe them as like developer portal / service catalog. Okay, what do you want? Do you want to be a service catalog and focus on the enterprise asset management element, or do you want to cater the developers? Those are two very, very different personas with very different needs. You can make the case for both. And if you're creating 200, 300 services every year, should you have a, you know, specific way of templatizing? I mean, sure. I'm just saying that how you prioritize to actually spend your money in different budget items should have a return on investment calculation attached. And that means, well, what's the element that we could do now that has the biggest impact and the biggest return on investment? And the answer is whatever. That's the answer of the organization. What I think I'm criticizing is that the organizations don't even do that. They just look at what feels most obvious. And then my interpretation is they say, where do we start? Well, we could look at the application lifecycle. Well, what's first in the application lifecycle? Well, the creation of a service. And so, like, hundreds of enterprises are now looking at standardizing the creation of a service. And like, if you really zoom in, they already do that. They have GitHub templates. Now they hide this behind a fancy JS layer. I just don't think that that's the ROI.
What do you think is the ROI?
Well, I've been really trying to dissect that and looked at a good amount of setups right now. And I thought about it like this. If the developer just updates a specific element of their code, right? Git push update, everything is running. CI is there, flows are there. I have my individual service. I'm working on that service and I'm updating that service, and the change need to end up in the cluster wherever. Yeah, then I actually don't need a platform for that, because that is pretty static. Nothing. There is no particular change in that situation. Now, you need a platform if you do anything that goes beyond the simple update of an image, think about it like this, or like a workload unit, whatever, wherever you run it. And that could be things like you add a new service and you tie this into the architecture, you update resource definitions across a large number of different services, you add a new resource, that you configure something, you move something from one environment to the other, you may be creating a new environment, you are creating a new service indeed.
you do specific rollback actions. You need to understand in an immutable way what happened between deployments. Like, these things are things that go beyond the update of an image. And the developer in these cases is actually confronted with a break in experience because they can do it themselves, which is usually ending up with a high cognitive load on the individual user because they need to dissect, well, how does that networking work now? And we've been throwing all this ability run it at them, so now they need to do everything. The second option is, well, you just throw that over the fence to operations. And I like to call that ticket ops. And I see that in a lot of organizations. They are, you know, Jira tickets, ServiceNow tickets. Can you debug this? Can you do this? Can you do this? The operation teams keep growing and growing and growing to deal with all of these demands of overwhelmed developers, and developers are waiting. And so these are actually the situations that you need to dissect and go to every single developer and say, how often do you go beyond the simple update of an image? If you, like, let's just normalize this against 100 deployments. How often do you do this? How much time does that eat from you? Okay, now you go to operations. How much time, if the developer comes with that request, how much time do you need for this? Well, then you can actually build a very, very clear prioritization. And you hear a number of voices. You hear the junior, you hear the senior, and then you say, okay, that's our research. Based on this, this is the decision we are making. And that ties back to the conversation we had earlier, right? Make it very clear why you're making decisions, and then pull through and execute them well.
Beautifully said. Very, very well iterated.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Mark again. If you'd like to hear more on developer experience, please check out Emily Freeman's keynote from the DevOps Conference 2023. It's called What is DX? Creating Great Developer Experience. I'll leave a link for you in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
So let's shift gears for a moment. Would you like to ask about the Kubernetes benchmarking study, Andy?
Yeah. So there was a recent study coming out from Humanitech, and it was about the Kubernetes benchmarking, where we are, what the top performers do versus the bottom performers, whatnot. And then there were four key takeaways at the end. And just reading through that, a lot of what they were saying just resonated so much with what I see. And I thought it would be interesting to, you know, maybe not walk through the whole study, but at least talk about the four key takeaways and what kind of things you saw that led into these takeaways.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, we are doing a lot of these studies. Frankly, we're doing them to a large degree also because I had the feeling that my decision-making also on the product side was just skewed. The data is not very accurate that is out there. And so we started to do these large-scale services, but like there are like in the thousands. This year, I think, is 1,000 something attendees. But we have larger studies with up to 3,000-4,000. And I'm always fascinated by that difference between high and low performers and how clearly certain things surface that where, you know, I always feel like I had a certain gut feeling about them, but they were very blurry to me. So I always found that very, very helpful. So yeah, the first one is that if you're not running Kubernetes yet, you should focus on getting that set up. So there is no, many people start with the other stuff too early. Like there, you need to have a certain period where you just get the fundamentals right. And that is security and setup and structure and making sure you are trying to use as many, I mean, that's my personal opinion, but I mean, hosting Kubernetes yourself, you can do that, but like maybe not. You should make sure to think about how can you automate these things as much as possible to have as little operational burden as possible. I do think in these situations where people start looking at this, you should already take into consideration how much you can shield the complexity of Kubernetes today. Many people are now branching and looking into things like ECS, large banks, where I'm not a huge fan because you're really locking yourself in, and then you'll have the next big transformation in 5 years. And so while you're getting the fundamentals right, already get a sneak peek of what's technically possible already to even out the experience for the developers. But a fundament has to be rock solid. Then second, and you can see that clearly, high-performing organizations have a high degree of self-service. And that is because of the stuff that I talked about earlier. If it's too complex and if there is no self-service, developers are waiting. I think a big time of this industry is developers just sit there waiting, and that's incredibly frustrating experience for them. Then what many, many people get wrong, and I think in my opinion also many vendors, like I would wish for more vendors that think about things more holistically, because you cannot only talk about Kubernetes. Kubernetes, I mean, is an orchestration layer itself. It's only as good as its combination with its periphery, if you want. You can't think about Kubernetes without thinking about the database, or the DNS, or the file storage, or whatever. It's, you know, the sum of all things. Self-service capabilities need to really look at the holistic thing and make sure you don't build even more islands. And then the fourth thing is that approach of layered abstractions. If you want to build an internal developer platform on top, never, one of my mantras is golden paths over golden cages. Humans react very allergic to things that work well even 90% of the time, but fail you 10% of the time. And you can actually feel that for yourself if you're using Amazon Alexa or Siri early days, and it worked in 9 out of 10 cases, you still didn't really trust the system, right? And that's the same thing with platforms. If in a daily workflow, these things work in 9 out of 10 cases, that's not enough. And in those 10 cases, in this 10% bucket, the individual user needs to be able to go beyond leave the path, if you want, and go down to the level below to actually configure stuff themselves. And again, that also holds true to, you know, accommodate the different personas. You have that type of person that wants to stay high level. They're okay with the defaults. They're actually happy with just focusing on React.js. But you have the Linux kernel hacker, and you can't put them in golden cages. They will snap and they will torpedo, and they have a very loud voice, right? A lot of the mistakes that we did with the platforms in the early 10s, if you want, were that they were too rigid, too abstracted.
We talked, you know, you were talking about Kubernetes and then building up some self-service, I guess some APIs around it, and then an IDP that will include the holistic environments and whatnot. And then you brought it back to what the individual people need. So I guess part of this, maybe the easy part is the technical transformation. Which tools do you use? How do you set up the technical workflows? And the hard part is how do you change the culture so all these individual users are willing to get on board and support it and use the platform you're building?
I think I talk a lot in these mantras, but it helps me, you know, sort my thoughts. I think about pull versus push. My observation is that push-based methods don't work. If you build something and it's built in isolation, and then you turn up at the doorstep and say, hey, there's this great platform. This is the lock-in. Let's go. Here is a training material. Why don't you try it out? I mean, I can't say I've been very successful with that method myself, although I really tried. And so my answer is a pull-based method to say, well, I'm trying to build that step-by-step guide to platforming. I'm always saying, okay, settle on a lowest common denominator tech stack. Don't try to build everything, right? And that's, you know, today probably containers and Kubernetes. Find a team of people they want something new. There's always this team of innovators. Once you have that, build something that's 10x better than what they have right now and focus too much time and energy on that small thing and make them fans. Because these fans will create your internal pull factor. Everybody else will want to be on that train wagon. And that, for me, has been the most powerful thing. And second, you know, I think the time horizon at which enterprises operate or companies really operate today is too short to believe that you can fundamentally change people. So I think you need to meet them where they are. And if they're today writing Terraform and they're really happy with it and proud of that achievement, don't take that away from them. Make sure they can still do that if they want. Make sure people self-select what's best for them and try to build the systems around that. That means probably you don't get the degree of standardization you want. It probably means that you have 3 CI pipelines and everybody's wondering, like, what the hell? Why do we have 3 CI providers? But I think, like, pick your fights and try to keep people with what they're used to and try to consolidate wherever possible.
Casper, I talk a lot about motivation in my daily work, and I introspect and meditate on it, and mantras, and, you know, good days and bad days. But it kind of comes down to a small set of motivations for me that at my age have kept me going. And then, you know, there's all these dark places that we go to, some call it even the black dog and things like that. But could you tell me a little bit about your personal motivations? And I felt like I empathized with you the day that I met you. Like, okay, I know some of the path. I've been in some of the rooms that you've been in. Tell me a little bit about what motivates you on a daily basis and how you keep going and how you face the dark times.
So I've been really struggling with that. It's hard for me to, you know, find an argumentation why there should be free will, if you want, and predeterminism has always been something that has been, you know, like a burden on me. I've been saying, okay, there's so much randomness and there's the butterfly effect and, you know, religion and everything. The thing that actually, you know, I probably looked at too much research on neuroscience, and they're all over the place. They actually have no idea, but they all have lots of different statements. So for me, I thought, well, that's all good and fine if you think about it in a theoretical way. But in the end, there is always a human that wakes up in the morning and something happens, and then that human is happy, or the human is sad, or the human is stressed, or there is a human that, because they're stressed, you know, they're not fair on their children or whatever it is. Now, because that's the fact, right? If you can do things that change the overall system to the better, if you want, then that's always worth fighting for. And that's always worth striving towards. Because in all of its abstraction and, you know, seeming predeterminism, we still feel something, and the system overall gets better if more people feel joy, if you want. And it's worth fighting for that. For me, that has different, you know, facets in my private life and how I'm trying to actually be socially active or help others. It's really important for me, and I keep telling that to also my colleagues. It's really important to give without ever expecting anything in return. And these things, like, you can, by, like, if everybody does that, we can change the world actually, and we can make a better place, and we can ease the burden on every single one. From a professional point of view, for me, that materializes in, I want to build things that make people's life better, in that case now with software. I've been building stuff before that didn't make people's life better, and that was, I couldn't work with the intensity I can work on this. I then did a software for non-governmental organizations, optimizing their approach, which worked well. I do think it helped a good amount of organizations, but it's still around actually. So this was a great experience. And then the next thing is this year, because I've always been working with engineering teams, and I always thought this mantra, you build it, you run it, is a little bit abusive, if you want, because the subjects that are supposed to run it, they weren't really asked whether they want that, right? So if you think about it like that, they were trained on being React developers, and now you want them to do everything. And that constant idea of shifting left, shifting left, shifting left is, I mean, from the medieval ages to now, we've been in every single industry, we've had separation of concerns, and we allowed people to focus on stuff. And we're the only industry that for some reason think it's cool to let everybody do everything. And that's, like, why? Because Werner Vogel says that in 2006? And why is he saying that? Is that maybe really good for AWS's, I don't know, margins? And I think the sentence is resonating really well with all of us, because as engineers, we want to be capable of everything, and we want to go into the weeds. And so it's meeting a psychological profile that never says no to technical complexity. But only because you never say no doesn't mean it's good for you, right? And that's the thing that drives me. Platform engineering is about making the life of others better and less stressful. That's really the core of what platform engineering is about. It's about psychological safety and being respectful towards every single user.
I just have to tell you that not only your mission and your way of describing it, but the fact that you have this goal, you have these values, and you also come out with the thought leadership and the capability to be able to share them with others, so that while we're on our personal journeys, we're able to also, you know, think about these things. It's just, you've made a fan out of me, Gospar. This is
that's very kind.
I've gotten to say that a few times lately. I feel very, very fortunate to be able to participate in something like this. I have two more questions that we've been asking all of our guests that come on. And the first one is, Gospar, can you think back to when you were a child? What is the first thing you remember you wanted to be when you grow up?
Yeah, I wanted to be a composer.
Ooh.
This was, that was my my dream for a very long time, until I was 17.
I applaud you. Do you play instruments?
I play instruments. I play the piano, and I sing, and I play clarinet now, and a little bit of bassoon. So I do a lot of music. And that's funny. It's very similar to software engineering. Actually, you have a very clear set of rules, but you can be incredibly creative inside of that system of harmonies. And so, yeah, that's that.
You bring Beethoven's sketches to mind, where if you listeners don't know, Beethoven would make lots and lots and lots of tiny little sketches. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, when we're building up test harnesses or doing experiments in DevOps kind of thing. So,
yeah, so
fascinating.
Writing complex scoring is nothing else. There are very clear rules. Hey, you know, you need to make sure that you don't have the dominant before the subdominant. And that's because the Western human ear, to be very precise, is very used to this, and it feels abusive. And so you want to make sure that you're following the rules in order to actually then please the listener. But still, you want to be creative. And so, yeah, this is a fascinating parallel.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. I'm still at 251. If I can get the one in there as well, or the six, then maybe I'm doing well. But okay. Second question, Gospar. Was there a point in your life where you either crystallized that you're on the right path, or you realized you're on the wrong path and you had to make a change?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Several. I think the one that was most apparent, like I have a large appetite for risk. So at that point, I took a large risk, and, you know, lots of people depending on that decision and lots of families, and we rescued that situation in the end. But in that situation, I did something that was so stupid. It made so little sense to make that decision that way. And I had a conversation with my father, and he looked at me and says, like, what kind of advisors do you have around you? And that was a turning point, actually, because I realized, you don't have the right advisors around you. Or I actually had the right advisors, but I wasn't listening the right way. And I wasn't listening the right way because I was too young or too immature or not humble enough. I was probably just not humble enough. And so that's when I said, okay, well, you need to hear that shot now, and you need to be more humble and listen to the experience of other people, because otherwise you need to make that experience. Like, if you have to make all of the experience yourself, like, life isn't long enough for that. You need to build on the abstractions of others if we want to stay in our theme.
Excellent. Very well put. I'd like to thank you again, Gospar von Grünberg, for joining us today and sharing so much of yourself and your values and your mission with us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Gospar. It's been great. And I think this is the first time we talked about from medieval times till today on this tech podcast. It's fantastic.
Yeah, we should do that more.
Yes.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Before we go, let's give our guest an opportunity to introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about who we are.
So I'm Kaspar. I'm the CEO and founder of Humanitech. I've been building software and software teams for the last decade or so, and I've been always fascinated by platform engineering. I'm fascinated by platform engineering because it can play such a large role in the sanity of a team and organization, and it can ease the burden on the individual contributor. So yeah, platform engineering and building internal developer platforms is something that I'm fascinated about, and I'm spending really all my day on. I talk a lot about platform engineering just for the sake of it, and about how to build platforms and the practices, and we do a lot of the community stuff, and we do this to help others be successful with that. And then I'm also building tools to help teams build scalable dynamic internal developer platforms, a couple of them open source, others closed source, and I'm always interested to exchange on that topic, so feel free to get in touch with me. I'm always encouraging everybody, not many people do it, but my mail is casper@humanitech.com, so if you have any idea, please shoot me an email.
My name is Mark Dillon. I'm a lead consultant in the transformation business at EffiCode.
My name is Andy Allred, and I'm doing platform engineering at EffiCode.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard, please like and subscribe. It means the world to us. Also, check out our other interesting talks and tune in for our next episode. Take care of yourself and remember what really matters is everything we do with machines is to help humans.